coarse features were shadowed with pain. They had him sitting at a table and chair that were slightly smaller than normal. You can imagine what that would feel like after a few hours. As we passed by him, he sold one of his rings to a woman who slipped it over her baby daughter's hand to make a loose bracelet. Then there was sort of a human zoo, the auditorium, which displayed physically odd people from other lands. I'd seen pictures of the Ubangi with large plates horribly distending their lips. Seeing the same thing in the flesh was discomforting, as were the giraffe-necked women from India, whose necks are slowly stretched by stacking rings on them as they grow. It was impossible to read their eyes. The African pygmies and Hibaro headhunters stared back at the tourists with curiosity and defiance, respectively. I suspect the Hibaros spoke with Hispanic New York accents when they took off their costumes and wigs at night. We went into the cool darkness of the theater of time and space for a voyage into the limitless spaces trillions of miles beyond the Milky Way. But about that time, the beer and heat and walking caught up with me, and I dozed until the lights came up. Elle said I didn't miss much. She had to catch a train to Washington at 6. I offered to walk her back, but she declined and told me to relax and enjoy myself. She might have caught my sideways glances at some of the more carnal aspects of the carnival, which of course I hadn't suggested. Anyhow, we embraced and promised one another we'd get together soon. I went into a place called the Hurricane Bar and treated myself to a new drink named the Zombie, which was, in retrospect, a mistake. It was sweet and seemed mild. I was thirsty and drank it down too fast. The effect was like downing a tumbler of iced rum. The kindly bartender gave me a worried look and a glass of ice water, but by then I was already somewhat looped. I did remember my hat as I navigated back out into the cooling afternoon. My unsteady steps took me back to a pavilion I'd heard of, criticized for its erotic content but artistically interesting, Salvador Dali's Dream of Venus. I was interested in both art and naked women, so how could I go wrong? So long as I didn't trip over my own feet, betraying my zombie nature. You entered the thing between two giant legs, on top of which was a 20-foot-high copy of Botticelli's Venus Rising from the Sea. It might not be the best attraction to visit drunk. I'm sure it would have been confusing enough sober. There were paintings on the walls and other things, too, like arms coming out and bas-relief body parts. But the main show was in two tanks, a dry one and one that was full of water. The wet tank had bare-breasted mermaids swimming lazily around, languidly tapping away on floating typewriter keys. A reclining female figure made of rubber had a piano keyboard painted along its torso. Every now and then, one of the girls would descend to pretend playing on her. There was a fake cow, bandaged up as if from a serious accident, placidly smoking a pipe. Smell of damp seaweed and mildew. In the dry tank, a sleeping Venus was attended by lobsters who seemed comfortable in frying pans over hot coals, bottles of champagne scattered around, and a couch in the shape of swollen lips. It was dark when I left Dali's extravaganza behind, and although I was getting my land legs back, I was also feeling tired enough to calculate the distance back to the train station and decided to call it a day. My hotel was just across the street from Penn Station. I could have a quick supper there and retire. Under a lamp, I consulted the map and charted a new route back through the fairgrounds. More breasts, as it turned out. Women in improbable tableaus about the history and virtues of advertising. Probably a foretaste of what picture radio would bring. Television, they called it at the RCA Pavilion. Anything to lure people away from books and the dangerous business of thinking. That was the bad taste the fair left in my mind. the road to fulfillment a sequence of shiny cars and appliances, cars and appliances that think for you. Would they free up the mind for more important matters? What do the people of 1960 do as they cruise automatically from democracy to future-topia in their 100-mile-per-hour wombs? I suspect they watch bare-breasted women selling them things on the Kodachrome radio. I couldn't get Electro out of my mind. I even dreamed of him as I dozed on the train. There was a real dog inside Sparko, but he was more like a wolf, silently snarling, and something like a man inside of Electro, but not a man of flesh, doing tricks, acting stupid, waiting patiently for its time to come, accumulating insults to return. The squeal and shudder of brakes awoke me. Penn Station downstairs was close and smoky. I rushed up the stairs, despite tiredness, and out into the street. I took a deep breath. It smelled fresh and clean. What was wrong with that? 11. Mating. For about 100 days, we'd been converging on the tankers, the 5 mountains of ice that we would carry to Beta Hydrii, fuel to slow us down, decelerating over the last years of the voyage. Back in the dawn of the space age, the logic of staging was clear. You used a big rocket to hoist a medium-sized one out of the dense ocean of the lower atmosphere. The big one detached and dropped back, one hoped, into an actual ocean or desert, while the medium-sized rocket propelled a little one out of the remaining atmosphere into space proper. There was no air to battle between Europa and here, of course, but the logic was similar. When we left the solar system, rather than accelerating all of the trip's fuel up to the midpoint in 5 huge packages, we sent 10 smaller ones, 5 of them tankers, automatons, lugging fuel, with no burden of crew and life support. They'd left about 6 months before we did, their progress carefully monitored. They hadn't accelerated quite as fast, but on paper it was a simple feat to have the 5 tankers arrive at spindown at the same time as us, and with the same velocity relative to Earth. But that velocity was a little more than 1/50th the speed of light, so we covered a distance the size of the United States every second. A miss is as good as a mile, they said in the early years of old 20th, off by a few orders of magnitude by our time. We'd stopped accelerating, except for the tiny nudges from steering jets, so wine glasses would show a proper meniscus again, until we began to decelerate 996 years from now. It was a complicated maneuvering waltz, one that we'd practiced several times in Europa orbit. Of course, when we were back there, all 10 vessels had been pretty close to one another all the time. But there, you also had to adjust vectors because of the presence of Europa and Jupiter. So, in theory at least, this was going to be easier. But if there were any problems, they were likely to be big ones. We were watching the slow progress of the Enterprise, projected diagrammatically on a large screen over the park. It was early lunchtime and pretty crowded, not too exciting. You might just barely tell a difference if you looked up every minute. For 2 years we had flown attached to the sterns of our fuel tank engines, the mass shielding us from the sparse but energetic rain of elementary particles and occasional dangerously fast dust motes. For the next 1,000 we would drift the opposite way, engines pointing forward for eventual deceleration. The view above us in the forward screen would still be pointed toward Beta Hydrii. No one wanted to spend a millennium looking at where we had been. It's like getting big, slow animals in a position to mate, I said. Did I ever tell you about the horse? Kate was carefully coating the top of her roll-up sandwich with mustard. You mated with a horse? Should I be jealous? I was 5 or 6, and our neighbors in Maine had horses, thoroughbreds. They'd borrowed or rented a male, a stallion, to come in to mate with one of their mares, and enlisted my parents' help. Horses need help to mate? What did they do in the wild? They didn't have thoroughbreds in the wild. I take it they're kind of specialized, not too bright about some things. Do tell. She put the sandwich down and smiled. You're going to tell. They told me to wait in the car. I didn't know anything about sex, but I could tell there was something strange about the visiting horse. It was stamping around and whinnying and had an erection like... I held up fist and forearm. 4 of them were restraining the animal. It half dragged them over to the other side of the barn. And you followed, of course. What kid wouldn't? I peeked around the corner and saw most of it. They had the mare tied up in a makeshift stall and sort of guided the stallion in. To the bullseye, so to speak. My mother and dad and our neighbors were pulling on lines with all they had, I guess trying to keep the stallion from injuring the mare or itself. The one who apparently owned the stallion was petting it and talking to it, and finally took hold of its dick and, you know, aimed it. Just in time, too. It started to ejaculate. And you didn't know? Nothing. Not for some years. I ran back to the car, pretty scared. Turns out my mother knew I'd seen it, but wasn't sure how to handle the situation. Oh, that was just before the war? And then your father died. She put her hand on my knee and squeezed it. So, ultimately, it was your mother who had to explain. Yeah, I laughed and maybe blushed. That I hadn't broken it when it happened to me. By then, I'd almost forgotten about the horse or buried the memory, but she reminded me, so a lot of things fell into place. Hard way to grow up. She was born 40 years after the war. I didn't think about it much, but in a way, we were from 2 different planets. She looked up at the screen. Like elephants mating, she laughed. Or worse, using their trunks. Nasal sex, what a talent. If everything worked, it would be almost completely automated. Each of the 5 ships would come alongside its fresh fuel tanker. About 100 explosive bolts would separate the payload, us, from the nearly empty old fuel tank. Steering jets would inch us over to where we were in place over the new tank. A few spot welds would suffice to hold them together. There wouldn't be much mechanical stress between here and Beta, and they would never have to be detached. Assuming we never had to make the trip in reverse. If we had to return to Earth from Beta, we'd have to build our own elephants. Time enough to worry about that 1,000 years from now. Manus would be the first ship to do the switch. I thought that was bad engineering, but I didn't get a vote. There were only 15 people aboard it, the usual skeleton crew from here. So the logic was that if something went horribly wrong, fewer lives would be lost. That was typical committee thinking. What would the rest of us do if Manus was destroyed and we had no facilities for retooling? Of all the 5 ships, it was the one we couldn't afford to lose. The only thing you could predict with certainty about the next 1,000 years was that something was bound to break down. So sure, let's risk the toolkit first. My suggestion, that we use Ars, Mech, or Mentos, distributing most of their 200 passengers among the rest of the ships, was politely declined. They'd done the numbers, they said. I wonder what they got, dividing by 0. How did the duck thing go? They think they can do it. That's going to be most of my afternoon. First, I've got to dress out one of the little bastards. I don't suppose you've ever killed a duck.
No, not that I haven't thought of it.
I did find a good Spanish recipe for duck, for which we had all the ingredients but stuffed olives and duck. The stuffing for the olives I could approximate with chopped sweet red peppers. The duck I had to kill and dress and carve up, so the food lab could analyze the raw meat and synthesize a restaurant-sized amount with the protein sequencer. All of my recipes had this unwritten first step. Go to the store and buy a duck or a salmon.